Here's a really special deal on a great product from our friends over at Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. You can now receive a $39 bottle of artisanal fresh pressed oil free if you just pay $1 to help cover shipping. And there's nothing else you must buy now or ever. It's a wonderful opportunity because with olive oil, my number one rule is the fresher, the better. That's because the olive is a fruit, and olive oil is actually a fruit juice. Like any other fruit juice, extra virgin olive oil is at its glorious peak of freshness, flavor, and nutritional potency when fresh squeezed. And that's what's missing with so many supermarket olive oils. After sitting on the shelf for months or even years, they've lost their freshness and can't compare with just pressed EVU shipped direct from the new harvest. Here at Milk Street, we really like these oils' vibrant, grassy flavors, as well as the intoxicating aroma, just like a garden in a bottle. Prove it yourself with no obligation to buy anything ever. For your free $39 bottle direct from an award-winning artisanal farm, go to getfresh177.com. That's getfresh177.com. One last time, getfresh177.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Christopher Kimball. Thanks for downloading this week's podcast. You can go to our website, 177milkstreet.com, to stream our television show, get our recipes, or take our free online cooking classes. Enjoy the show. This is Milk Street Radio from PRX. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Nathan Myhrvold was the first chief technology officer of Microsoft, and he's also worked with Stephen Hawking to uncover the secrets of the universe. But he is also passionate about food science. In his latest three-volume encyclopedia, Modernist Pizza, Myhrvold dives deep into crust toppings, why Pizza Margherita was not named after a queen, and why you should be making more pizza at home.
Pizza is funny because it is much more widely eaten than it is made. Yet, it's actually not that hard to make at home. And it turns out even bad pizza made at home is pizza. It's not that bad.
Also coming up, we learn a Venetian recipe for pasta with radicchio and walnuts. And Adam Gopnik explains how to cook for your family when everyone has a different dietary restriction. But first, it's my interview with journalist Larry Tye about how the father of public relations, Edward Bernays, made bacon and eggs the American breakfast of choice. Larry, welcome to Milk Street.
Great to be on with you, Chris.
Edward Bernays is one of my absolutely most favorite historical figures. Who was Edward Bernays?
He was a man who was so convincing as to what he was doing that he convinced the world and the New York Times that he was the father of public relations. And if father means the first, he wasn't. But if father means the most inventive PR man that the world could have ever dreamed up, he was. He was the nephew of Sigmund Freud, and he took his uncle's ideas on why people behave the way they do and used them to make people behave the way his clients wanted them to. And to me, he was most of all the father of spin.
So let's frame this period, World War I into the 20s, this notion of the masses, the crowd, and whether there was going to be chaos. And Bernays felt that there was a way to control people by understanding their, I guess, subconscious desires, right?
Right. And he felt that the people who should be pulling the strings and exercising that control were people like him, the shapers of public opinion who could ensure that the masses did things that were good and appropriate and going to steer the economy in a way that his clients wanted it to go, which was all the way up.
Let's hear a little bit from Edward Bernays right now. Here he is during an interview with Ball State University in 1986, talking about creating the field of public relations after World War I.
When I got back from the war, I recognized that ideas could be as important weapons as anything. And first, I called what we did publicity direction. I would direct the conduct of people so that they could win, through ideas, their public goals.
Okay, let's turn to Bacon, one of his great successes. Mid-1920s, the Beechnut Packing Company produced Bacon. And I didn't know this, but at the time, Americans had turned to a very light breakfast. The 19th century, it was heavy, a lot of meat, but not so in the 1920s. How did he turn that around?
So a normal publicity person would have said, geez, we're going to try to compete with our fellow bacon makers, and we're going to try to steal some of the market from them. Bernays said, no, if Americans aren't eating bacon, none of the bacon makers are going to be profitable. So he redefined what breakfast ought to be about, and he persuaded a famous New York doctor to write his colleagues and asking them not a neutral poll on what people should be eating, but the way he phrased it was, he wanted to know whether they supported a hearty or a light breakfast. Now, the very word hearty was clearly skewing the poll and ensuring what Bernays knew would happen, which was that hearty won big, and that newspapers spread the word, and that people started following their physician's advice. And the advice was, eat a hearty breakfast. And Bernays said, a hearty breakfast is a bacon and eggs breakfast. So what he succeeded in doing was making the ultimate artery-clogging breakfast forever linked in the American mindset with what a hearty and healthy breakfast was. And that continues in households across the world to this day.
If you don't like bacon and you're interested in your health, as 4,000 doctors say that you better eat bacon, you'll do it.
Mm-hmm. Bacon and eggs and buttered toast. There's nothing like a good, healthy breakfast to start the day off right. And a meal like this should satisfy anyone.
I still believe it. I'm all for bacon and eggs. But what's so interesting here is a good example. His skills, his ability to convince the quote-unquote masses to buy something or think something is simply a skill that could be used for good or evil, and he was on both sides of that coin?
He was absolutely on both sides, and at times he used it for good, and yet it was also, it had huge potential for harm. And Edward Bernays was told by an Associated Press reporter in the 1930s that his book was on the bookshelf of Joseph Goebbels, of Hitler's PR and propaganda chief. And on the one hand, Bernays, as a Jew, was especially shocked by that and dismayed. And on the other hand, he told enough people about it over the years that I also think in some sense that he was proud, that he could never really distinguish the good from the bad. So he helped addict a generation of women to smoking cigarettes. And then two generations later, he worked for the American Lung Association to help wean them of the habit that he had created. And what Eddie Bernays said was, geez, if I had known the dangers of cigarettes back when I was helping convince women to smoke cigarettes, I would never have done it. And that all would have been very convincing, except he left all of his records to the Library of Congress, and they show that one of the few people in America who truly understood the dangers of cigarettes back in the 1920s and 30s was Eddie Bernays and his buddies at the American Tobacco Company. He started becoming so addicted to his success with these public relations techniques that he could no longer see good and bad and no longer see truth and some of the lies he told.
Right. Here he is on David Letterman in 1985, explaining the benefits of being called Dr. Bernays despite only having honorary degrees.
All right, now, doctor, tell me again what the doctor is. What are we dealing with here? You're the father of public relations.
What we're dealing with really is the concept that people will believe me more if you call me doctor.
Oh, I see.
So there's a lot of takeaways. He imbued products with an emotional resonance. He used quasi-medical research and other research to support the value proposition for a product, and also that if you say it loud enough and long enough, it becomes true. Are all of those things still in play today, and has the ball been advanced down the field beyond what Bernays was doing?
I think the techniques are the same that Edward Bernays used 100 years ago. He worked for the biggest manufacturers of food in America, and he helped sell us on the idea that everything from unhealthy cereal to what we were discussing with bacon and eggs was the way that you could truly get the day off to a healthy start. And what Edward Bernays did was take his uncle Sigmund Freud's ideas on why people behave the way they do and use them to make people behave the way his clients wanted them to. And I think that that is precisely what companies are doing today. A hugely more money is being spent on all of this, and it seems more sophisticated, but the techniques were set in place nearly a century ago, and it's just refinements.
Larry, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for being here on Milk Street.
Chris, thanks for having me on.
That was journalist Larry Tye. His book is The Father of Spin, Edward L. Bernays and the Birth of Public Relations. Now it's time for my co-host, Sarah Malt, and I to answer some of your cooking questions. Sarah is, of course, the author of Home Cooking 101, and she stars in Sarah's Weeknight Meals on public television.
So, Chris, you know, we always talk about having a cocktail when we're done doing radio. What cocktail are you going to concoct after radio today?
Well, I don't usually concoct them because I'm a person of deep habit. Mm-hmm. Which means that I basically drink old fashions.
Okay.
But a friend of mine in Paris actually sent me a bottle of, it's a creme de noyau, it's noyau de Poissy. It's a liqueur, this is a David Leibowitz who just came out with a cocktail book, made from the insides of stone fruit kernels, you know, the pits.
Oh, wow.
So it's slightly almondish.
Yeah.
I think in the Middle East it's called Maleb, it's M-A-H-L-E-B. Anyway, so the recipe, it's called a jockey club. It's 1.5 ounces of dry gin, 3/4 ounce of lemon juice. I know this by heart because I've made a few of them. 3/4 ounce of this liqueur, which is not easy to find. You have to special order it. And again, noyau de Poissy, P-O-I-S-S-Y. A little sugar syrup, if you like, just a tiny bit, and some bitters. It has a slight almond flavor. The gin is nice, you know, the botanicals and the gin. And the lemon juice makes it almost a cooler. It's very refreshing. So it's the perfect balance of alcohol, herbs, lemon juice, and a slight undercurrent of almond. And it's just spectacular.
That sounds great. You know, it's interesting. Years ago, when I was in France, we were introduced to a chestnut liqueur. And you were supposed to add it to white wine. And I thought, how odd. But in a similar way, sort of the acid of the white wine worked really nice with the sort of deep chestnut flavor of the liqueur.
Ooh, that sounds good.
Oh, so good. Oh, geez. Well, we'll have to finish up our questions here so we can get to that cocktail.
Yeah, we're just going to have formal cocktail hour after radio instead of just talking about it, right?
I think so.
Okay. Let's get back to work. Take a call.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, my name's Eileen.
Hi, Eileen. Where are you calling from?
Outside of Philadelphia.
How can we help you today?
Every year I make a pumpkin roll, and it always cracks when I roll it. So I Googled and found they suggested rolling it with the parchment paper. So I tried that this year and it was the worst ever. And I'm wondering, it almost felt like it was too wet. I don't know. Like, I want to know what the secret is to rolling a pumpkin roll without it cracking.
Yeah, well, I would think the parchment did keep it too wet. What I've always done is turned it out onto a very lightly floured or confectioner sugared tea towel or, you know, kitchen towel, and then
right.
let it cool off enough so that you can handle it, roll it up with the towel, and then let it cool, and then you can unroll it and proceed. That should work just fine. I also wonder if maybe you're slightly overcooking it if it cracks.
I've always done it with the towel, and it still cracks on me, but maybe I am overbaking it.
Yeah, that's what I wonder. Chris?
I agree. It's amazing.
Oh, dear. What happened?
Dear Diary, I agree with Sarah. Yeah, the parchment's a terrible idea because it won't breathe and the tea towel will absorb the moisture. I would say, however, you do want to roll it up while it's pretty warm. I mean, you don't want to let it cool, then roll
no,
it up.
No, just enough so you can handle it is what
yeah,
I was saying.
Yeah, but within a couple of minutes, two or 3 minutes coming out of the oven, you want to roll it up, let it sit. But I think Sarah's right. You should probably underbake it a little bit. There's still cooking going on once it comes out and that'll finish it up.
Yeah, I probably am overbaking it then because I keep looking and the center seems too loose. So I, you know, give it another minute. Maybe that's the problem.
I'm glad to hear
what you said about the parchment because that really frustrated me. It was really a mess.
Oh, dear.
We'll put that in the big dumb advice box, right?
Yeah. I agree.
Can't believe everything you read on the internet. Right?
It's a very big box.
Ain't that the truth?
It's full of stuff in there. So anyway, give that a shot.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
This is Milk Street Radio. If you need a hand in the kitchen, give us a ring anytime. That number is 855-426-9843, 855-426-9843, or email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Ruth calling from California.
Where in California?
I live in Mariposa, which is right outside of Yosemite National Park.
Oh, lovely.
I feel terrible. I mean, I feel terrible. I don't live there. That sounds great. So how can we help you?
Well, I have the wonderful privilege and luxury of being able to have my own pigs living here. I have 7 acres and a tiny farm. And every year when butchering time comes, I'm absolutely flummoxed with the butcher instructions. I don't really feel comfortable with the choices that I've made. And I guess I wanted to ask you guys probably know better than me. And also, do you have any tips on making lard? Oh my God, I'm completely flummoxed.
Well, the lard, you want leaf lard, and that's the lard around the kidneys. And you get a butcher to save that for you.
Uh-huh.
Then you have to cook that down. Usually it's done very slowly over a few hours with some water in the pan, Dutch oven or whatever you're using. Cook it very slowly until it melts. Strain it off. Put it into small containers of one kind or another, even ice cube trays, whatever you want.
Oh, good idea.
That leaf lard does not taste like pork. It has a very clean taste. And it's what American pie makers used traditionally for making pies because you get this incredible leafy texture to the finished baked pie dough. So that's the lard you want, is the stuff around the kidneys.
No, I just wanted to clarify one thing because I'm learning here too. When you say you render the lard by combining it with water and cooking it low in a Dutch oven, is that in the oven or on top of the stove?
You could do it either. I do it on top of the stove. The water is there so you don't overcook the lard. You just want to melt it very slowly and then strain it off for any bits. I would use that for cooking because it's a very neutral flavor.
Oh, okay. Any tips on butcher cuts? Like picnic shoulders versus Boston butts? I'm totally confused.
Well, a picnic shoulder is the upper arm, essentially the front leg, the upper part of the front leg, and the Boston butt is the shoulder. So
right.
The Boston butt is going to be a better cut because it's got more fat in it.
That's the one you'll use for pulled pork.
Yeah, that's used for barbecue. A picnic shoulder will be a little leaner because it's got more muscle in it.
Fabulous. What is your favorite cut, both of you?
It's the Boston butt. You know, I use it all the time. A quick recipe. I mean, if you take three onions, shove it in an Instant Pot or a Dutch oven, saute it with about a third of a cup of smoked paprika and a bunch of other spices, nothing too spicy. Cook it for a few minutes, throw in 3 to 4 pounds of cubed Boston butt, you know, pork shoulder, 3/4 cup of water, bring it up to temperature, cook it 40 minutes, you're done.
Emergency dinner.
It's fabulous.
Also add at the other end of the spectrum in one of the leanest cuts would be the pork tenderloin. It's the most tender cut, but it still has wonderful flavor. And I cut it into medallions and treat it like little steaks, like little filet mignon.
Oh.
I use that as a quick saute, you know, with like mushrooms, make a sauce of some kind. Cut it into 2-inch thick medallions and then smush it, saute it, and make a sauce. It's yummy.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Well, you can also take a tenderloin and cut it into 1.5-2-inch pieces, put a spice rub on it, let it sit a few minutes, and just saute it off in a skillet. And that's, you know, Spanish bar food, pinchos morenos, serve it over rice or a salad. Just a great meal, and it's, you know, a 10-minute recipe.
Okay, fabulous. Oh, you guys are awesome. Thank you so much.
Well,
thanks
thank
for calling.
You. Yes.
Bye.
Bye.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. Up next, the founder of modernist cuisine, Nathan Myhrvold, busts pizza's greatest myths. That's right up after the break. I'm Christopher Kimball, and now here's a word from our friends at Allagash Brewing Company, who love food as much as we do here at Milk Street.
Hi, this is Jason Perkins. I'm the brewmaster at Allagash, and I've been making Allagash White in Portland, Maine since 1999. So a white beer is a very old style of beer. Traditionally, it was brewed with spices of some type, typically coriander and orange peel. And I think one of the things that makes Allagash White distinctive and different is the rare combination of complexity and drinkability. And it's sometimes remarkable to stop and realize that I never get tired of it. You know, I'll open a can or I'll pour a glass and the first sip and I'm like, man, this beer is good. There are a lot of different ways that folks can enjoy an Allagash White, and here are some of the examples of what folks here at the brewery like to do.
My favorite thing to pair with an Allagash White is simple, beautiful seared scallops over a bed of fresh greens with blood orange and shaved fennel.
My favorite would probably have to be like an Italian or a hoagie. Capicola, pickled vegetables, crusty bread. It's got that nice lemony, zesty character that just gets you ready for the next bite.
The ultimate pairing for me is this dish called bosam, which is this like big pork shoulder with like salt and brown sugar. We also call it candy pork in my house, and a little like scallion ginger sauce. It's like lettuce, rice, pork, sip of white, lettuce, rice, pork, sip of white, and it's just perfection.
My other top choice was like a hot dog. Like, just have a hot dog and have an Allagash White. You don't need to dress it up.
There's something about mussels with beer, especially the white, that is just so good.
I feel like it goes really well with different soft cheeses that aren't too dominant, but then also with like spicy Indian food. So I think it's just really versatile.
I could imagine like something like lemon meringue pie. That would be really nice.
Pairing Allagash White with carrot cake is a thing of beauty.
This maybe it sounds really boring, but pepperoni pizza. I feel like after a long week, having like a nice warm pepperoni pizza and a cold Allagash White is just like you made it. Like you did your week. You deserve this pizza. You deserve this beer.
It's perfect in summer. It's perfect in winter.
I haven't really found a flavor that I don't think works really well with Allagash White.
Yeah, so not only do I drink it while I cook, I often cook with it. So if I'm creating some kind of stew, I'll add a little bit of Allagash White to it.
A lot of people use Allagash White in like a fried fish batter.
Anywhere where you can add like a spritz of lemon or a spritz of lime, that could be the beer.
We are very food-minded here at Allagash, obviously. And I think because of that, Allagash White is kind of subtle in a way that not all beers are. And I think that makes it very food-friendly.
I think it tends to unlock qualities in the food that you otherwise wouldn't necessarily notice.
Like it's not too hoppy or it's not too sweet, so it sits right in the middle and sort of brings the flavor of the dish to life.
If you ask anyone here at Allagash, we're pretty much all stands for this beer. We love it so much because every time you have it, you pick up something new.
Every time you come back to it, you're reminded like, oh wow, yeah, that's really good.
This is Jason Perkins again. Just wanted to say thanks to everyone at Allagash for sharing. You can try Allagash White at home, too. Head to allagash.com/locator to find Allagash White near you.
For 21 plus only, please drink responsibly. Allagash Brewing Company, Portland, Maine.
This is Most Street Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Right now, it's my interview with the founder of Modernist Cuisine, Nathan Myhrvold. His latest book is Modernist Pizza. The three-volume, 1,700-page guide answers every question you could ever have about pizza. Nathan, welcome back to Milk Street.
Well, great to be here.
I can't say I read your book because I didn't have 6 months in a cabin on top of a mountain. But I did go through the book, and I have to say it is amazing. The amount of work that went into it is fascinating, and going through all the history and talking about what's not true and what is true. But let's start with a question you ask at the beginning of the book, which is, what is pizza? So, you know, in Lebanese, you know, Middle Eastern cooking, there are a lot of flatbreads.
Yep.
That might have some za'atar on it or something simple. So any topping on a flatbread, is that pizza?
No, not by the definition that we picked. Those other flatbreads may be wonderful, but we chose to pick a particular lineage. So this is very much like saying there's probably a lot of wonderful people in the world named Kimball, but only a small set of those are actually relatives of you, Chris.
Right.
And that was the idea we had with pizza, which is, out of all of the world's flatbreads, one particular flatbread rose up and conquered the earth. And that flatbread originated in Naples in the 19th century. It mutated into many other forms as it left Naples and conquered the world. And so for us, pizza is all of the things related to that.
Okay, so let's talk about the book. How big is the book? What does it weigh? How many pages is it? And talk about your lab. I don't know if it's the same place I visited.
You
were kind enough to make me lunch years ago. But it was stunning. So describe the book and the lab.
Well, the book is three hardcover volumes and then one spiral-bound kitchen manual. It comes in a stainless steel case, which in honor of Italy and famous exports of Italy like Ferraris, we painted it red. So the goal of the book is to explain everything we know about pizza today. That includes history, that includes the science of pizza, and it includes more than 1,000 recipes, including recipes of many, many different styles of pizza. So you have Detroit pizza, you have Chicago deep dish pizza and Chicago thin pizza and St. Louis style pizza, and depending on how you count it, up to a dozen of these variations. You could even say Tokyo Marinara is almost getting to be its own style of a pizza.
And tell us about your lab. I mean, you have a lot of equipment there, 3D yeah. printers, this and that, the other thing. Which are the things you actually use on a regular basis to do a book like pizza?
Well, we have a large kitchen that I don't think there's any restaurant in the world that would be better equipped for cooking equipment. We also have a lot of scientific equipment, which you'd find in a really well-done food lab. And we have a machine shop. So the goal of what we have at the lab is to have all of the equipment, tools, and people necessary for us to do thousands of experiments. You know, when people say, oh, do X because that makes it better, I always want to test it. Because a distressing number of times in the world of cooking, X doesn't make it better. Or it does, but it's not really worth it.
So in your testing, because you are a scientist at heart, were there any fundamental myths about pizza that were disproven in your research?
So you have people who say, oh, you can't make pizza without having the water of Naples or of New York City. That's wrong. We tested that extensively. We did that in part by bringing water back and then doing side-by-side tests in our kitchen with the water of the supposed magical place. There's a lot of people that will use excessive fermentation times. Oh, another great thing was like, what kind of oven? Oh, that a coal-burning oven is so much better than a gas-fired oven. Well, it turns out when people say coal-burning ovens, the place that really perfected this was in New Haven, and it wasn't coal, it was a product called coke, which was used for the metalworking industry.
Right.
And coke is a perfectly reasonable fuel because it doesn't emit this stinking fumes.
No, I've cooked on a coal stove. It does smell. Yeah,
it smells horrible.
Right.
But the people who are doing this on a coal stove because they think it's traditional don't actually know that their ancestor who did it never used coal. They used coke, which is totally different and doesn't smell.
So how did pizza get to America? I mean, one of the things I love about your book is you disabuse of these silly historical stories. So what was the real deal? How did it really get here?
Well, you had lots of residents of Naples wind up in the United States.
Right.
And they started making food for themselves the way they knew how, and they included pizza. And it got popular. Pizza was popular in New York and in a variety of cities by 1900. In fact, we found there was pizza on the West Coast, you know, just a few years after there being pizza on the East Coast.
Pizza Margherita, I've been, you know, there's certain stories I've been telling all my life.
Yeah, they're wrong.
And they're all wrong. So what's the real story here?
Well, we don't know how Pizza Margherita actually originated. There was a charismatic story that this one pizzolo created it for Queen Margherita, who was the first queen of Italy. The problem is, I found a play written in Naples about 20 years before Margherita was queen. And in the play, there is a pizzolo and a customer, and the customer orders a pizza with mozzarella, tomato, and basil, which is the classic margherita. Right. So it clearly was something that existed in the town for a long time. And it's one of the problems with trying to figure out the history of pizza is that essentially everyone you ask has a reason to lie.
That's a good historical quote. Flour, I think in general, you're in favor of high protein flour, like in the 14% range. But a lot of people over the years have talked about, well, gee, in Italy, sometimes they use a very low gluten flour, or they talk about double zero flour, which is very finely milled versus coarser mills. To what extent does flour make a huge difference here?
Part of it depends on the style of pizza that you're going for. You know, I think you can make a pizza crust out of any flour you'd make bread out of. And bread flours generally are higher protein flours than not, and that really aids in creating the structure for the bread. If the protein amount is too high, and or if you use the wrong technique, like you try to do it without letting it sit overnight, what you'll discover is that the dough is too strong. And that means as you try to spread the dough out to make it nice, thin patty, it stretches right back up. So that's the problem with having one that is too high in gluten, but with the right technique, you can do well. Now, if you're making a Chicago deep dish pizza, the recipe for that was originally developed by African-American women. Hmm. It's sort of a not well enough told story that it was black women chefs that developed the recipes that's for deep dish pizza originally. Hmm. And their original recipes, which are made today in many of the pizzerias, they're almost like a pie dough that you put yeast into. And as a result, you could probably make those with a very soft flour, low protein flour. The same thing is true for the cracker-like pizzas.
Right.
If you really are trying to make a cracker-like crust, it's actually much easier on you to go and use a low protein flour.
What's the difference between, in your mind, between New York-style pizza and Neapolitan pizza?
So New York-style pizza has got a whole bunch of differences. One is it's usually bigger. You know, the standard pizza in the New York world is an 18-inch pizza. You know, the difference from a dough perspective is we would definitely put some oil in our New York dough, and we would not cook it anywhere near as hot.
Right.
A traditional Neapolitan is cooked in a very hot oven.
I timed it. When I was there, it was 70 seconds, I think.
Yeah.
It's fast.
It's super fast. Then there's this whole thing about whether you need a wood-burning oven or not. I have come to regard wood-burning ovens very much like I regard unicycles. you know, if you go to a Cirque du Soleil show, they'll probably have one of the elements with, like, people on unicycles doing amazing stuff. And if you're one of those Cirque du Soleil people, hey, a unicycle is awesome. But very few people commute to work on a unicycle. It's not that efficient. It's more of a stunt. But if you master a wood-burning oven, okay, you master a wood-burning oven. You can't make a better pizza than you can in a gas oven. Or, for that matter, an electric oven.
Boy, you're going to catch some flack for that one.
Well, I'm sure I am.
This is the Nathan Myhrvold we all know and love. I just want to say that. So is there... I know you have lots of recipes in your book. Is there a particular recipe you'd want to give people now that would be like the basic at-home pizza recipe?
I think the first thing is people get afraid of bread or pizza because it involves this fermentation step, and they're afraid it won't come out. But there are few things cheaper than flour. So I totally encourage people to experiment. Pizza is funny because it is much more widely eaten than it is made. Yet, it's actually not that hard to make at home. Now, if you say, okay, you want to make the absolute perfect Neapolitan pizza as good as a professional in Naples, okay, that will require some effort, just like it required that guy some effort. But you can make pizza at home. There's nothing to be afraid of. And it turns out even bad pizza made at home is pizza. It's not that bad.
Nathan, a pleasure, an education. It was entertaining. I just love the book. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
That was the founder of Modernist Cuisine, Nathan Myhrvold. His latest book is Modernist Pizza. Everyone loves pizza to the point that anything goes. In Germany, they use canned tuna. In Sweden, it's banana curry. In Russia, they top pizza with tuna, mackerel, and salmon. In Australia, it's kangaroo. And in Japan, you can order pizza with squid. But in Naples, where pizza originated, they stick to tradition, marinara and margherita. No squid, no curry, no kangaroo. So if you travel to Sweden, skip the pizza and order the national dish, meatballs. Or as they say, when in Rome. You're listening to Milk Street Radio. It's time to chat with J.M. Hirsch about this week's recipe, pasta with radicchio, walnut, and black pepper. J.M., how are you?
I'm doing great.
You know, you just got back from Venice a few months ago. I was there 2 or 3 years ago, and we had very different experiences. I was eating blue-collar food in places that had no menus, and you were getting slightly fancier food, but not much fancier. You found, among other things, a bunch of pasta dishes, which I was not familiar with, which is one of the great things about Italy, right? There's just an infinite number of things you've never had before.
Absolutely. I mean, every time you turn a corner, you're encountering yet another pasta dish that you've never heard of, and yet is simple and delicious and uses, you know, kind of the best of whatever is fresh and local. You can never run out of pasta in Italy.
This one uses walnuts and radicchio and pepper, which is an interesting combination.
Right. So I was working with a home cook, Francesco Bernardi. He's actually a librarian who is obsessed with cookbooks. He's taught himself how to cook. And he loves researching kind of the local ingredients and the local pastas. And after taking me on a cruise on his boat through the canals, we did some shopping at the market. And we go back to his apartment and made just this wonderful, blissfully simple pasta that combines all these kind of tastes and textures, these kind of high and low, crunchy and tender. And it was all based around radicchio, which was wonderfully so fresh, so crisp, so ever so slightly sweet and bitter at the same time. And it really was a terrific and simple pasta.
Is this a dish that requires cooking other than the pasta? Are you cooking the radicchio and walnuts, or is this all raw?
You toast the walnuts just to bring out kind of their savory meatiness, and you're very, very briefly sautéing the radicchio in a little bit of olive oil, of course, and that olive oil you're just going to barely season with a little bit of garlic that, you know, you like we've learned so many times in Italy, you throw the whole garlic clove in the olive oil, you let it flavor the oil, then you throw the garlic away because you don't need it anymore, and you're just going to combine those ingredients. When the radicchio is just barely tender, you're going to throw in some pasta, you're going to throw in those walnuts, the parsley, black pepper, of course, more olive oil, this is Italy, and just some wonderful salty cheese, some Parmigiano, and it comes together, the whole thing is on the table in about 20 minutes, and I just loved the contrast of the tender pasta, the crunchy walnut, the sweet, bitter radicchio, the fresh, herby parsley. This the whole thing came together so wonderful. And of course, the Parmigiano melts and brings everything together so perfectly.
And that's what I love about great Italian cooking, right? It has a variety of textures, mm-hmm. you know, walnuts and radicchio, pasta, and also bitterness, yeah. right? Spiciness, yep. sort of funkiness in the Parmesan. It's simple, but it's not simple.
That's what makes it so great is, I mean, we're talking, you know, what, 10 ingredients here total? And if you include the olive oil and the salt and the pepper, but nothing is simple about it, even though it is such a simple recipe, because you have all these contrasting tastes and textures, these highs and lows, and so that every bite is interesting and delicious, of course, but interesting. And that's something I think we forget about a lot of times, that food should be interesting. It should intrigue you as you're eating it. And this is certainly one of those dishes.
And you got to go to Venice.
I got to go to Venice. No harm there.
J.M., thank you. Pasta with radicchio, walnut, and black pepper, some Parmesan and parsley. A simple dish. It's even better than what I had. Thank you, J.M.
Thank you. You can get this recipe for pasta with radicchio, walnut, and black pepper at milkstreetradio.com.
This is Milk Street Radio. Coming up, Adam Gopnik tells us why we no longer define ourselves by what we eat, but rather with what we don't. We'll be right back. I'm Christopher Kimball. You're listening to Milk Street Radio. Right now, Sarah and I will be answering a few more of your cooking questions.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Mike from Columbia, South Carolina.
Hi, Mike. How can we help you today?
Well, I'm excited to talk to y'all. I went to make that Jose Andres, the garlic and the bread soup from Spain with the paprika. And, you know, we don't keep a lot of bread in the house. And I notice a lot of the recipes that call for bread and soups will say, oh, you take your day old, your old bread, and you tear that up and you use it in your soup. And I often will think of making something like this at the last minute. And I wanted to know, is there any reason that I can't just use fresh bread, some kind of rustic bread? Is there something structurally putting that into the soup that a fresh bread wouldn't work as opposed to using something and waiting a few days after buying a loaf.
Well, you know what's really interesting is the thing that people don't understand is actually stale bread absorbs more liquid than toasted bread. So it becomes mush. You could certainly use fresh bread. It will mush up. If you want a little bit of structural integrity, I would go ahead and toast the bread, and it will still absorb some of the liquid, but you'll have something, I think, more interesting. Like you, I like artisanal bread. I either make it or I buy it, and I keep it in the freezer sliced, well-wrapped.
Gotcha.
And then I just take out what I need every single time. I mean, as a matter of fact, one of my favorite things to serve with soup is what I refer to as faux garlic bread. I toast the bread, and then when it comes right out of the toaster, I brush it with olive oil, I rub it with a cut clove of garlic, and I sprinkle it with sea salt.
Nice.
Now, I'm sure Chris has something to say about this.
I've actually made this recipe with Jose in his house a few years ago, and he used stale bread.
That's fine.
It didn't turn soggy, really. I think the bread actually kept its shape pretty well. I mean, I would say the more important thing is what kind of bread. If you're making this garlic soup with the smoked paprika, the pimenton, you want a dense country loaf, that kind of bread.
Okay.
But I would say you could certainly slice it and leave it overnight, or you could cube it and put it in a 350 oven for 20 minutes to dry it out. You do want to dry it out because it will keep its structure better, I think, in the soup or the stuffing. 350, 20 minutes, cube bread will solve the problem.
Perfect. I think so. Type of bread over age, and yeah, we can modify it to make it stale as needed. Well, that's great.
Yeah. That garlic soup, it's got four ingredients and is one of my favorite soups in the world.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
You've helped change the way I cook, which is sort of like the byline. And we really love the show and all that you do. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Michael. Take care. Bye-bye.
This is Milk Street Radio. If your cooking is in a rut, give us a call. Our number is 855-426-9843. One more time, 855-426-9843. Or simply email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, it's Donna from Foley, Alabama.
How are you?
I'm great, thank you. How about you? I love your show.
Oh, thank you. How can we help you?
Well, just a question about chicken broth. I always save carcasses in a Ziploc in the freezer, and then I make broth with it. And I've noticed, you know, after you cook it for an hour and a half or so, obviously the meat has no flavor whatsoever. And I don't know what the process is by which the flavor is getting into the water. And I don't know if I should be cooking it like long, like 6 hours, or if I should, or an hour is sufficient. And I also was wondering if it's better if I chop all the bones up to get more bone in there. I have no idea.
Well, let's go back into history. I mean, the reason people made stock like this is because they never threw anything out, so they'd have a carcass, or they'd have leftover cooking water, you know, bits of vegetables, and so they just throw everything into a pot on the back of the stove, on the back burner, right? And they let it go all day,
right,
and they keep adding things over the course of the day. So it was when someone was in the kitchen all day, that's what they did. Yes, the flavor will leach out of the meat and the bone. You should chop it into like 2-inch pieces is a good idea. As Sarah will probably about to say to you, they often roast the bones first to get some browning and Maillard reaction, which adds flavor. And you should probably let it sit at least for a couple hours in lots of cold water and reduce over time. You can add lots of other ingredients like parsley or quartered onions, other things. If you want a really quick way to do it, chicken wings are the best. That's what we use. Take a bunch of chicken wings and put them in water to cover. You can do this in an Instant Pot in about 30 minutes. And there's so much collagen in those wings, which adds great body to the stock and flavor. So if you have a carcass, cut it up, simmer it for 2 to 3 hours, right, Sarah, until you have flavor.
And I would cook it, you know, this is another thing that Chris makes fun of me about. I would, you know, at a bare simmer to make sure that you don't cloud it up because you want it to be clear. You know, I'd cook it for 2.5 hours, you know, and after you strain it, if it doesn't taste strong enough, just boil it down till it tastes like something.
Or go out and buy a jar of Better Than Bouillon. They make chicken, beef, and vegetable in a little glass jar. It's a paste. You use 1 teaspoon per cup and 1 tablespoon per quart. It's actually quite good. It's not as good as this.
Yeah. Well, I think the nice thing here is that she's using up leftovers, getting a second life out of them.
I do love to use up those leftovers.
Yeah.
And I think, Sarah, that I'm hearing you say that if I don't want it to be cloudy, it helps not to boil.
Correct. Right. Particularly because you've got all those little meat bits in there.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
This is Milk Street Radio. Now it's time for some culinary wisdom from one of our listeners.
Hi, this is Bonnie Bomberger from Madison Lake, Minnesota. My tip involves breaking eggs for cakes, etc. I just lay out a thin tea towel on my counter and then gently tap the egg on that. Cracks beautifully every time, and any egg that leaks out is absorbed by the towel. Thank you. Bye.
By the way, if you'd like to share your own cooking tip or some advice on Milk Street Radio, please go to 177milkstreet.com/radiotips. Next up, let's find out what Adam Gopnik is thinking about this week. Adam, how are you?
I am very well, Christopher. How are you today?
Pretty good.
I have just come out from under one of the strangest gastronomic culinary cooking experiences of my life because I had both of our kids, their partners, and their dogs, and everyone to feed all the time. And here's what makes it complex. One is a vegetarian.
Oh, here we go.
The other is totally gluten allergic. One is a vegan. Next one is a pescatarian. And this is where it gets really complicated and baroque. The gluten allergic one actually loves red meat and strong tastes of all kinds. So I had to take this into account. One dog had significant stomach issues and had to live on boiled chicken and rice. And every day I would sort of make the rounds trying to figure out what am I going to cook tonight that will satisfy this astounding roster of allergies, aversions, and preferences.
I think oatmeal and almond milk.
That probably might have done it. But first of all, I got interested, as you know I tend to do, in what we might call the larger question. When did this become so prevalent, right? 20 years ago, the waiter did not say to us, is there anyone in your party with allergies? And now it's absolutely mandatory that they say it. I was actually doing some reading, and according to one report, one study found that about 10% of adults and children diagnose themselves as having a food allergy of some kind, while medical testing shows that about 2.5% actually do. Now, I don't mean to be mean-spirited about this, because you have to respect everybody's aversions and allergies because they testify to them. But it does seem to me that this is a construction that we've created for ourselves where everybody has a very, very strong kind of personal Maginot line of what they can eat or not. And rather than thinking of that as the culinary Maginot line, I realize that we have crossed what I think of as the Brillat-Savarin line. You remember Brillat-Savarin, maybe the greatest food writer and food philosopher, for that matter, who's ever lived, right? He was the man who wrote The Physiology of Taste, and he was the one who said, so famously, we are what we eat. Show me what you eat, and I will show you who you are. Now what we say to each other is, show me what you won't eat, and I will show you who you are. We define ourselves by our distastes.
Right.
The end of dining at the table is to find something that is neutral and acceptable to everyone. So I was struggling with this day after day. What dinner would be acceptable for the entire table? Chris, you are a fellow cook. I turn it over to you. Given that range of demands, what dinner would be acceptable for the entire table?
I think you have to go to the Middle East, which is mostly vegetarian.
Right.
And so it's vegetables and grains and fairly bold flavors, and you're not eating meat, and you're not eating much wheat. You know, I think that's where I would go.
Absolutely.
Bahadura, lentils, rice, and caramelized onions.
Lentils, rice, couscous, those are all good things. I did have, though, I had a vegan and a vegetarian, and as you know, vegans and vegetarians are sort of like, Lutherans and Unitarians. We think of them generically as Protestants, but they don't think of themselves as belonging to the same faith at all. I went to Greece a great deal, so I would make roasted fish with a salsa verde, sautéed spinach over baked potatoes, asparagus charred in a cast iron pan, and I learned how to do a clafoutis, which is one of the simplest and most delicious of desserts, with rice flour and almond flour instead of wheat flour. And then there was also yellow rice and couscous, which the dogs loved too. So on that basis, exactly, of going to the Mediterranean, I managed somehow for 5 consecutive weeks to please my family.
5 weeks?
5 weeks. We had everybody here for 5 weeks, including the dogs. One of the dogs, an absolutely adorable puppy named Ruby, managed to break every glass table in the house.
I think you deserve some sort of national honor for this 5 weeks. I do have a theory, though, which is I think a lot of this has to do with the health movement, of which I was part a long time ago, which is self-diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
I think self-diagnosis is a way of people taking control of what they think is wrong with them, so they feel they're in control of their bodies. And that's why people, my mother used to say, I can't tolerate lemon juice, you know? And I'd go, why? Well, it messes up my stomach. And it made her feel good that she diagnosed herself and took an action to make herself better. And I think that's really a powerful thing in this culture right now.
I think so, too. It's a way of taking command over some small part of our lives. It's also a way of explaining all of the little bumps and bruises of well-being that we all deal with. But it is astounding to me that we have broken through the Brillat-Savarin line. We really are all defined by what we won't eat.
So what does it say about people who eat everything?
It says that those of us who remain omnivores are archaeological creatures. We're the dinosaurs and the relics. You know, if you think about it at all, back 20, 30 years ago, that was the cutting edge of eating, right? I'll eat anything.
That's a good point. Nose to tail.
Nose to tail. My friend Fergus Henderson in London, the late lamented Anthony Bourdain, their whole ethic was eat everything and eat anything. And that's totally stood in its head now. Now the whole ethic is eat as little as you can, as suspiciously as you possibly are able to.
Once again, the future is leaving us behind. Adam, thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris. Take care.
That was Adam Gopnik, staff writer for The New Yorker. That's it for this week's show. If you tuned in too late or want to binge listen every single episode, you can download Milk Street Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. To learn more about Milk Street, visit us at 177milkstreet.com. There you can find our recipes, take a free online cooking class, or order our latest cookbook, Vegetables. You can also find us on Facebook at Christopher Kimmel's Milk Street and on Instagram and Twitter at 177 Milk Street. We'll be back next week with more food stories, and thanks as always for listening.
Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is produced by Milk Street in association with GBH, executive producer Melissa Baldino, senior audio editor Melissa Allison, producer Sarah Clapp and Jason Tureski, production assistant Amelia McGuire, and production help from Debbie Paddock. Additional editing by Sydney Lewis. Audio mixing by Jay Allison at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Theme music by Tubab Crew. Additional music by George Brandel Egloff. Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is distributed by PRX.
You know, I grew up with Vermont farmers who made do with tools they had on hand. A hammer, pliers, and baling twine, of course, for most jobs. When I became a cook, however, I found that having just the right knife or maybe the perfect carbon steel skillet made all the difference. And the right tool also added pleasure to my cooking. I truly enjoyed my time prepping as well as cooking food. And that also goes for a car. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. And that includes available dynamic sky panorama glass roof, available front row massaging seats, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, and available multi-terrain select. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, this is Chris Kimball, and I need your help. We're working on a story about the battles we all have in our home kitchens. Maybe you're tired of your partner telling you how to cook, or maybe they always leave a mess, or maybe you're frustrated by your loved one's highly restrictive diet. We want to hear about your kitchen dramas, from the biggest food fights to your everyday grievances. You can leave us a voicemail at 617-249-3167, 617-249-3167, or send a voice memo to radiotips@177milkstreet.com. One more time, call us at 617-249-3167 or email us a voice memo at radiotips@177milkstreet.com. Please include your name and where you're calling from, and thank you.